Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, this is Tax Tuesdays with Toby Mathis and
Jeff Webb.
Hey, welcome back for another fun-filled day of playing with the tax code and trying to figure out what the heck all these rules are and how to maximize your tax savings so you can actually keep more of what you earn. So this will be an interesting day. Just as an aside, as we record right now, we still have that hurricane off the coast of Florida, and I'm just devastating the Bahamas. So our prayers and thoughts go out to all the folks that are impacted by it. I'm sure that a lot of our clientele are impacted by this. So hopefully you get by with the least amount of damage possible. But on a tax side, if they declare it a federal disaster area, then you can at least get some tax relief.
Yeah, we can get relief in forms of any losses you might have. Also delays in filing tax returns if you're affected.
Yeah, and this isn't tongue-in-cheek either. This is, you have to have federal designation, otherwise they don't let you write those things off. So,
and it usually doesn't happen right away, so, but don't sweat it, it almost always happens.
Yeah, but those poor folks in the Bahamas, oy, oy, oy. All right, let's jump into Tax Tuesday. Stuff, freebies, always remember to go in and visit our YouTube channel, our Facebook channel, if you like filling your brain with lots of asset protection, tax, and estate planning knowledge, anything that we can do to help you preserve, protect, and prosper. That's what we try to do. So we're always coming up with new content. Feel free to join us. Send your questions to TaxTuesday@AndersonAdvisors.com. We get a lot of them. We go through them. We pull out of those, depending on when you send them. I try to get them a few days before we advertise the question. So usually by, you know, if you really want to see it get answered, make sure that you're doing it a week ahead of time. But we're still pulling them out as of yesterday afternoon. If you need a detailed, specific response that's on your situation, you need to be a tax client or a platinum client so that we can answer that. We can't just go through your stuff, your personal stuff on the air. It's confidential, and I'm sure you wouldn't want me to start getting into all that. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. So the whole idea is that you guys learn as much as possible and that we go through all this fun stuff so that you start picking up on it. I see people all the time at events that have been through the Tax Tuesdays, and the constant refrain that I get is I'm starting to understand the questions before they're even asked. Like, I already know what's going to be asked. I already know a lot of the responses, and that's exactly what, that's perfect. That's what we want. We love that. So let's jump on in. Opening questions. Can a married couple file a joint federal return even though they live in different states? We are paying our son's rent while he's in dental school. Is there a deduction we could take for that expense? We'll answer those. I purchased an investment property in another state and formed an LLC. Can the LLC reimburse me for the flights, hotels, and meals incurred prior to formation? We'll go over that. I'm going to deed my rental property into a California LLC. How do I pay the mortgage if it's still in my personal name? I am a new real estate investor, welcome, and am purchasing two properties with cash through my LLC. What kind of financial records should I keep? We'll go through that. I have co-wholesaled properties 50-50 with another investor. The deals were made in my company's name. Do I claim disclose the entire amount or only what I received as profit? Can I submit the mileage driven from my main work location to a branch office to my employer for reimbursement? What is the best entity for flipping raw land on an installment sale? Interesting. Can I form an LLC to purchase a vehicle, then lease it to myself, and then use an accountable plan from the C-Corp to reimburse me for the lease payments? That's interesting. How can I rent my home to a corporation in which I am a shareholder? We'll go through all those. We'll just jump right on in. If you guys know, we're always trying to be done in an hour, although I think in the last 90-plus sessions, we haven't hit it.
Okay.
So, yeah, but we're going to shoot for it today, Jeff.
It's a holiday weekend. And
so maybe we'll do an hour. Maybe we won't. We'll see. All right. Let's see. Can a married couple file a joint federal return, even though we live in different states? And when this question came in, it was actually one spouse living in California. It was a really long question. So I took some editing to make it so where we could fit it on one screen. But what it really boils down to is they're married filing jointly, federally.
Right.
But one lives in California and the other one doesn't. California has a very high state income tax. And the question is, can the other one avoid it on their income?
So starting with the question, on your federal return, you have two choices, married filing joint or married filing separate.
Mm-hmm.
And married filing separate usually ends up much worse than married filing joint.
Mm-hmm.
So the government, federal government demands that you file together in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Where the difference comes from is if you're actually residents of two different states,
mm-hmm.
that you may file separately in each of those states as a resident of one, California, and wherever the other state was.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a lot of this it was the opposite of this, when the California had the registered domestic partners, where we were having to file separate federal returns, but we were filing joint California returns.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if one of the spouses are, say, in Texas or Tennessee, they can claim to be a non-resident of California.
You're going to get audited on it by California.
California is one of the states that they want you to be a resident forever.
And the answer is, yes, you can. You can actually do this because there's your tax home, there's your physical home, but your tax home quite often is going to be your physical home. And they're going to try to prove that you really reside in the jurisdiction where they actually can tax, hit you the hardest. The big case that actually was just decided in the Supreme Court not that long ago was, you guys have probably heard me rail on this, was Hyatt v. Commissioner. It's a case out of California that's gone up to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, twice now. And has been appealed on three different issues. The Supreme Court ruled one way, and then when it came up again and it ruled another, it's like, you gotta be kidding me, where they actually dispatched franchise tax board agents to his home in Nevada. And the issue was a lot of tax on the sale of a business, and they wanted to show that he was actually residing more in California than he was anywhere else, and then they could assess their tax. So just know that you're going to have to deal with that, which means go in with the understanding that you're going to have to prove it, which means you're going to want to show, like, how many hours you're spending in that location, how many utilities you're using. And I'm not kidding. You're going to have to show where your cars are actually registered, where your driver's license is, all these things to show that one spouse is really residing in another state. And then the question is it worth it? You're going to have to look at it and say, hey, basically, this is the amount.
Yeah, California in particular really looks for, what relationships do you still have? Mm-hmm. Do you have property in the state, the driver's license, like you mentioned? Unfortunately, I think the spouse in living in California, especially if you were formerly a California resident, could be a deal breaker. I think the FTB is going to go after it, that no, you're still technically a resident.
They like to audit it, but there have been people that have won. I remember looking at it once, I want to say a couple of years ago. They tend to scrutinize them, and there was an attorney who actually, it was like a blog article, so you could probably Google this stuff and maybe find it out there, said, here's the cases. They tend to dispute them all, and then here's when you're successful, here's what they show. And they give a little bit of a laundry list. Anyway, so there's that. Man, we got a lot of questions that have come in since the beginning, though. I'm going to see if any of these are really relevant. Can I do an installment sale on federal but a conventional sale in California? So that's interesting. I believe California is going to have to follow, but do you know? So it sounds like he's selling a property, and would he be better just to recognize everything? I think you have to make
I want to say that you might be able to do that, treat them differently.
You're making a installment sale election on the federal for
right.
Sure. And the question is, I think California follows the federal, but I'm sure you might be able to say, hey, but I don't want to be treated that way for California purposes. Although I'm not sure why you would do that. The whole idea is to spread it out over the receipt of it.
The only thing I can think of is, for example, California doesn't recognize real estate professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have a gain on your federal side, but you could end up having a loss on the state transaction.
Okay.
Because you haven't taken all those deductions, but
maybe
just throwing it out there. I'm not sure that I've.
So you can't do a real estate professional in California?
No, they do not recognize it.
So you can't take the deductions, non-passive. That's brutal. On your state taxes, on your federal, you can. That's no fun. None of that's fun.
It's California.
Well, anyway, so if you're doing an installment sale, that's when you escrow threw me into the situation and explained a little bit more. So they said, hey, we want you to do a tax election on the federal side, but we want to treat it as a conventional sale because you have the election. You get to choose whether you want it to be an installment sale, period.
Right? Yeah, I don't know why escrow would have any say in that.
Yeah, I'm thinking that you're getting some weird advice on that one. They maybe push back on them a little bit because buyer has to withhold payments. Since when? If foreign, or I don't know why they're withholding payments on it. That's weird. I'd have to see a little bit more. So if you can, maybe email it in so we can take a look at it and dig into it.
Are you a non-resident of the state? Might be the reason they're having to withhold tax. But I
don't even know if the state would be the issue. I guess maybe it would be the issue for California. But if it's otherwise, the withholding is only for non-U.S. citizens.
Well, yeah. The state's like if he was non-resident, if he was a resident.
Right.
Arizona.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. Like the only one I know where you definitely have the withholding is on the federal side, on the state side, I imagine. But again, yeah, a little more facts. California buyer has to withhold escrow, also had to withhold state tax. So it's the state tax, but he lives in California.
Weird.
Yeah, I don't know about that. You may want to query and see what's going on there. Unless they're being forced to withhold if they do it as a installment sale in California, which again I've not seen that. Let's see, somebody else. There's a whole bunch of questions, but does the calendar of days in the state affect the state resident's decision? It's a factor that they use, but it's not the deciding factor. So if you live outside of another state and you spend a lot of days outside the state. What California cares about is, well, how many days did you spend here versus those other places? And then what, you know, where's your true tax home?
Right.
And it says, if you have a C corp for various business activities and I want to do wholesaling, is it best to do it under a child LLC to separate the brands and liabilities? If so, how should the child LLC be taxed? Yeah. If you're doing various business activities, you want to separate them out. What Juan's talking about there is having a C corp and having it owned separate LLCs. They would be disregarded LLCs for tax purposes that flow up. And then is there a sales tax on the sale of rental property in California in addition to K-1 flowing through?
I don't know of any state that has sales tax on the sale of real estate.
Yep. I don't think you're going to get hit. All right. We are paying our son's rent while he's in dental school. It's very nice of you. Is there a deduction we can take for that expense?
No, I'm sorry. That's a gift. There's no deduction at all for paying the rent of a relative.
Mm-hmm. But this is where we got to put on our thinking caps. We need to have a business first off. And so here's the big question. Is your tax bracket higher than your son's? If the answer is yes, then you want to pay him out of a business and have him actively participate for that business, actually do something for that business. And then if it pays him, then he can receive that money in a much lower tax bracket, quite often zero, and he could pay for his own,
right,
his own rent. So you're just paying him. He is paying tax on that money at a lower bracket, and the rent is still being paid. You're still coming out of pocket, but instead of you doing it personally, if you run it through a business, then he can work for the business. But he actually has to do something for the business. So you'd actually have to get him on your board, have him do things. A lot of you guys know that I had a daughter go through college and I had her do social media and things like that. Stuff that was pretty high value, and there's a wide swath of what you could pay for it. If it's sweeping floors, you're gonna have a tough time going above, you know, $25-$30 an hour. But when you're doing technical stuff, a reasonable amount can be a pretty high amount. If they're acting or doing Screen Actors Guild rates for photography and things like that, when you're using for modeling, that's actually a tax court case, in case some of you guys think I'm being goonish. There's actually a case where it was a young individual, I think they were 11. It was a pretty low age, and they were given a reasonable amount, was whatever the Screen Actors Guild. So I just think that stuff's a lot of times misunderstood, but you got to actually do something, and then you're paying it. As long as we're talking about school, I just did a little section on this. A lot of people go to the 529 plans, which are great. You put money into them and you don't pay tax on any of the growth, so long as it's used for education. And it could be private school for elementary school and high school and all these things now. It doesn't just have to be higher education. But man, your returns really stink. Like, I get the calculator out and because you have to stick it in mutual funds and they charge so many fees. There's just not, you're really not getting much. So I tend to shy away from those. There's sometimes we get into uniform gift to minors act and some of these accounts. But the problem there is when I see parents doing that is the money goes to that minor when they hit 18 and you have no choice if they're going to use it for college or they're going to, you know, spend it on a Lamborghini. You don't get to choose on that. The other one is using an index universal life or whole life policy where you put extra money into it when your kids are young. And under section 7702, it's 26 USC 7702, the cash value grows tax-free. And when I say tax-free, I'm being deliberate with that word. I'm not talking it's deferred. It's literally tax-free as long as you borrow it from yourself if you're going to use it for school. And then, you know, the good thing is you may not have to, you know, pay it back if you keep that policy in active, that when you die, the policy gets paid back. And if you don't, if the kid doesn't need, you know, say that your child has lots of scholarships and doesn't need the money or just says, hey, I'm okay, then you don't have to spend it on education like a 529 plan. You could just keep the money in there. You can use it for your retirement. Somebody says the dental student might also qualify for tuition credit to reduce his income tax. Yep, there's that. And again, what I do with my daughter, and I'll tell anybody if they have kids and they're underneath a certain threshold as far as income, let's say they're making less than $40,000 a year, forget the actual amount, it's over 100 grand, but you can do a Roth IRA, and that's a great savings plan. People look at me and go, you're a goon, Toby. Why are you putting it into a Roth when there's so many penalties to take it out? And I'm like, no, there's no penalty to take the amount that you put in out. There's only a penalty if you take the amount that it's grown out. So if you put $5,000 in it and it grows to $6,000, you can take that $5,000 back out anytime. And if they never have to touch it and they get it there for 20, 30, 40 years, you just took care of their retirement. Can an individual sole proprietor sponsor a 401k plan? The answer is actually yes, you can, although all of your income is considered wages. So you if you're making over $30,000 or $40,000, it could be a negative situation for you. And it also depends on your 199A deduction, how much you're making. So yes, it can do it. If no, why not? No, you can do it. But we just recommend that usually you're going to use a corporation, an S, or an LLC taxed as an S, and take a salary out and control how much you're actually putting in there. Let's see, dental student, we already did that one. On the tax organizer page titled expenses, there's a line called equipment rent. Could this include a monthly cost for lease car used to drive to various education seminars for stock? So just a crazy thought. Yeah, don't do that. We'll get to the car stuff here in a little bit. We always get a car question. I'm just always going to tell you guys, unless you have a really good reason to have a car in your company, you reimburse mileage instead. It's 58 cents a mile right now. You know, you just have to track your mileage. Use MileIQ. It's a simple app. I think it's free. So it's really simple. You can make sure that you're just tracking it. It literally GPSs. So it just says, was that a business trip? And it doesn't matter what car you're in. You just keep it and submit it. And 58 cents a mile, and it adds up. And you don't have to worry about 50% or more or bonus depreciation or anything like that. Do you have an opinion? You were sitting over there kind of mute today.
No, I was just listening. No, I don't like the idea of putting these vehicles into business, especially if they're not those 100% use vehicles, which the majority of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some personal on it.
You just said that's really important. There's going to be a personal tax.
There's a personal issue with that.
People do not realize this.
Personal usage is taxable to you.
There you go. Whenever I, as an employer, give a benefit to an employee, it's considered taxable unless there's a specific exclusion that says it's not.
Right.
So, for example, if I give you a soda pop, it's taxable unless there's a de minimis fringe benefit rule that says it's not. If I give you a car and it's my company car, the company owns it. And by the way, I'm going to scare the pants off you here in a second because there's actually a really good court case that I just read on a company car. That company car is a taxable benefit to you. You have to track your business miles, and the personal mileage is considered personal compensation. It's subject to self-employment, or not self-employment, but old age, death, and survivors, and Medicare, Social Security taxes, mm-hmm. and withholding. It's like if I paid you with a Lamborghini, I gave you a $200,000, $300,000 car, you have to pay tax on it.
People I'm okay with that.
Yeah. But a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of accountants don't realize that. And so they'll have this automobile and they'll just write 100% business use. And the IRS knows that's not the case. You're low-lying fruit, and they zap you and they say, all right, where's your mileage log? And you say, what are you talking about? And where you try to concoct something and they deny it. And they say, great, the entire value of that vehicle based on its fair market value is the lease value is going to be added to your wages every year. The other thing is that really hurts is when you are zipping around in your company car and you get into a car accident or somebody does on your behalf, A, it's commercial insurance. It's going to have to be the higher insurance. And B, you just put the liability in the company. And there was a case here that got a little bit of attention where it was a $100,000 personal liability. And the individuals caused a traumatic head injury on it. They hit a bicyclist in a on the road. They just hit him on the side of the road. And it was a truck. And then they sued the business trying to get to the business's $1 million policy. They dug their heels in and fought it and it ended up being a $3.6 million verdict. Well, there's only $1.1 million of coverage for the business. What do you think the business is doing now? They're yelling at the insurance and it ends up just being a nightmare situation for that business. And the guy's saying, I wasn't on business. But the lawyers on the other side, they're going to sue anybody that they can get their hands on. And unfortunately,
and the other side of that that I've seen is those people who decide that commercial insurance is too expensive, so I'll just use my personal insurance. Mm-hmm. If they're driving on company business, get into an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not only do they have the accident problem, their insurance company may say, no, sorry. Yep.
You got to make sure that it's that you're letting them know it's commercial use. Two other questions that relate to that, and I forget how we got into these cars. Aloha, Zach. And it says, regarding company car, what if we already bought the car? How do we take advantage of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act tax deduction? So what he's referring to is, depending on the vehicle, we used to do what's called a set 179 deduction and then depreciation. 179 is the first $1 million of equipment purchase you can write off in a year, but there's limitations depending on whether it's a luxury automobile or whether it's not considered equipment, just a passenger car. So they usually limit it. I think it was like $16,000 a year was the maximum amount.
Yeah, it's actually $13,000 a couple years ago.
Yeah, so what is it now? Is it still the same?
It's 20, right around 20.
And then you have bonus depreciation, which under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act says, hey, if it was something is written off over 5 years, 7 years, or 15 years, you just write it off in year one if you elect.
Right.
So in that one, there's still limitation if it's non-equipment. So it depends on the type of car. So if it's over a 6,000-pound vehicle weight, yeah, so if it was an SUV or something, you probably were able to write it off. Then but here's the problem. Ready for the problem, Zach? Is this? I don't want to freak you out. You got to make sure you're using it 50% or more for your business. If you're not, if you touched a 179 deduction, then it's ordinary income. You have to recapture it. If it's bonus depreciation, you just have to recognize the personal use of it, right? It's not going to affect your bonus depreciation on recapture, is it?
No, I think it is. And I think it's also going to affect any type of accelerated depreciation.
Yeah, you got to be careful. Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So if
it's going to be ordinary
income. If you're just using straight line, you're deducting a fifth of the value every year.
You wrote it all off in year
fine.
One.
But if you write, we had, speaking of luxury vehicles, I had a client who bought a Bentley within his company.
wrote it all off?
Oh, no, he didn't write any of it off. We had to explain to him that his deduction was limited to like $11,000 the first year. And later on, it was $1,775 a month because it fell under the luxury vehicle rules.
Yeah. Ouch. So the answer to you, Zach, is to make sure that you're using it 50% or more for business. You know, again, just use MileIQ. Somebody said it, you have to pay something for it. Yeah, I think you get free for like 40 or 50 trips. I think it's a couple bucks a month or something. Just get it. It's cheap.
But you figure at 58 cents a mile, if you drive the standard $1,000 miles a month, that's paying you $580.
Hey, guys, look at this. Hey, guys, love your advice last time about cost segregation. You just saved me a heap, $118,000 off my taxes. You may want to teach this again. Carolyn, you're reading my mind. We are probably going to, I'm going to introduce you guys to that concept again, and we're going to keep going. Yeah, usually you make big, huge chunks of money. All right, somebody says, if I own 6 large vans for passengering school-age kids, would you recommend a separate court for each of these vehicles and lease it back to myself to keep liability away? I own 6 large vans. Wow. My company has 6 vans and then you're using them. I see. It's a daycare. So you have a bunch of vans that you're using What I'm going to say is it's not the vehicle that causes the liability, because cars don't drive themselves. It's the individuals in the daycare. So what I would say is keep the daycare. Don't have a ton of assets in that daycare. And yep, and, young drivers, make sure you have good insurance. And then here's the big one for you, is make sure you have a umbrella policy on yourself. I call that lawyer's insurance, and you can get a huge umbrella. And I'm talking, they're pretty cheap. But you can get $3 and $4 million worth of coverage, you know, for $1,000 a year, something like that, or less.
What about, I mean, I like the idea of having the vehicles all in one place. There's fleet discounts on insurance. There's other.
There is.
They're treated differently for tax purposes.
But you have them in the, so there's always the, where's the liability come from? The liability comes from the employees of that daycare. So what I'm going to want to do is get the money out of the daycare, get the assets out of the daycare. The vehicles themselves, you're going to write those off. And I used to do liquidation. You know, you buy vans for $500. They're just not worth a lot when you liquidate them. Because when you auction them, you know, realistically, nobody even gets to inspect it. They're just they're popping out there and they're just bidding on. They have some pretty interesting rules on how to liquidate things out. And they have wheels and can roll away and have somebody pull things out of them so that they don't operate, you know, anymore. It's like most people don't go after you for your vans. You know, what they're going to go after you for is if they can get to you individually. So make sure you have an entity for that daycare. They really just want to, you know, lawyers go after the low-lying fruit of the insurance policy unless you give them a really good reason to go outside of it. So just make sure you have lots of insurance on it. Make sure that business is separated, and then make sure your other assets are not in your name. So if you have rental properties, don't have them in your name. You're just asking for someone to come after you and try to break the veil of the business. And that's the easiest thing. What you'll find is that things settle out and don't don't get filed. They're usually in an investigation phase, and they say how much insurance you have. You tender it, and you're good. When you have three rental properties and they can see them and they think you have something, then they just go right after you.
And I would say if you own the daycare property, I would probably separate that also.
Yeah, if it's the real estate, you'd actually lease that to your you'd set up. The active business is usually going to be an S or C corp. And for those of you guys who have listened before, you can have an S or C corp that is an LLC that is taxed as an S or C corp. You would have your real estate in a separate LLC. Generally speaking, it's going to be either a partnership or a disregarded LLC that flows down on your return on your Schedule E. And you're going to lease it to the active business. We do this with residential assisted living. We do this with daycares. You do this with any business. You're going to have real estate in an LLC, doctors, lawyers, exactly what I do in my business. Our buildings are held in LLCs. They lease back to the law firm. And the whole idea is you're just keeping the activities separate. That's really, really important, is that if you have something go wrong on your property, on your real estate, you know, in the case of a daycare, let's say that, I don't know, somebody trips down the stairs, they're going to sue the daycare. They're going to go after that property no matter what. Yeah. What you want to be able to do is isolate out the liability to the extent possible so that if they come after you as the landlord, there's that liability. If the landlord gave it over to the daycare, now you're trying to say, it's the daycare. I've created a line. When you're walking up here, the daycare is responsible. I have very little culpability, if any. And what you're trying to do is get, you know, keep that equity out of the firing line.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
See, I am a realtor sales associate, and my company requires me to place my broker as additional insured. Can I write off the portion on my premiums? Absolutely. They're just as an additional insured. You're probably not paying too much. They're just saying, hey, you want to cover. A lot of you guys are saying you can hear fine, so everything's good. So it's probably a little bit of. All right, here we go. I purchased an investment property in another state and formed an LLC. Can the LLC reimburse me for flights, hotels, and meals incurred prior to formation?
Well, you know, we don't talk about that. We talk about startup costs a lot in corporations. But actually, any entity can have startup costs, including an LLC. I mean, these are costs that you incurred trying to establish your business and all. So this is something we would capture and, or you would capture and amortize. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's perfectly acceptable.
So this gets fun. So I'm kind of I think these things are fascinating. If you already have investment property that's offered for rent, then it can write off all these things as a startup expense whenever you start bringing in the money. But if you don't, now it's going to be a startup expense and it's going to have a little cap on it. A, it's going to be limited to $5,000. Anything above that, you're going to amortize over, 15 years?
15 years.
Yeah, ouch. But you can only write off the flights and hotels and meals where the property is purchased. So I remember this going back. There was a guy and he looked at three different states and he was trying to look for properties. And so he went and he looked in New York. He went to D.C. and I think he went to Georgia. And then he bought the property in D.C. and he wanted to write all the expenses off. But he couldn't because it wasn't in the geographical area that he did the investment property, which is why we tend to use management companies where we don't care. We're just, hey, if it has to do with you're doing something on behalf of an LLC, we're going to write it off. And it's an active trader business, which is something that we didn't hit on here. You can only write off really the travel. You can't write off other expenses. Now, I'm trying to think of a whole bunch off the top of my head, but there's expenses that you cannot write off, ordinary necessary business expenses, because it's not an active trader business. These are investment expenses and they're much more limited. So, you know, there's things that here, I think the hotels and flights and meals would be fine. But if you had other expenses, interest, if you had ordinary office expenses and things like that, you wouldn't be able to write it off, period. You'd actually have to have the rental property in activity. And then even then, there's certain things you can't write off.
Right. Some of those expenses you would probably have to end up capitalizing into the cost of the property.
There's some. And then there's some expenses you just flat out can't write off when you're dealing with an investment property versus an active trader business. The biggest one is if you guys do seminars and things like that, you just can't write them off as in an investment. You can only write them off as an active trader business, which means we use a corporation. This is interesting. So you could, in your case, they would be able to reimburse themselves as soon as that investment property is available for rent. So it has to be available. So it's not that I have it rented. Like, let's say I'm rehabbing it and I rent it and then they move in. Let's say I have it rented on August 15th and they move in on September 1st and it's available on September 1st. The date you can write off those expenses and capture them is September 1st, because that's the date it was actually available for rent. Same thing as if I make it available for rent on September 1st, but I don't get a tenant until October 1st, I still can start writing off as of September 1st, because it was ready and available for rent. That's always the big trick. It's not when I acquired it. It's not when there's a tenant in it. It's when it's available for the tenant. Even if they rent it ahead of time, it's still not available to the tenant until it's done. Did I misstate anything?
No, I think the best way, the easiest proof for available for rent is an ad or something that says it was available for rent.
Mm-hmm. Two other questions. I'm partnering in a flip with somebody 50-50. So anytime I see these, I just kind of go, 2 months long. That's what they all say. It's going to be a 2-month flip and it's going to be a 2-year flip. Okay, what is the best form to create this partnership? Do I create LLC as individuals and both our companies create a new company as a tax benefit? When you're flipping, you're going to want a corporation between you and the activity from a tax standpoint. And when you're working with somebody else, you're going to do this in one of two ways. You're either going to do a joint venture where you both have control and you're going to do a joint venture LLC between the two of you. Or if, for example, you are in control of this, I'm going to advocate for you to not have a partner in it. I'm going to say if they want to participate, they loan you the money and you do a contingent interest where you pay them 50% of the gain as interest. And that way you write it off. You don't have a fiduciary duty to them and it's much, much, much cleaner.
We actually have a question on this.
We do? Where?
It's coming up.
Oh, good. I saw when he asked it here. Another question. I know. I know there's but I don't know if it's the exact same one. All right. So they said, hey, what about what's the difference between donating product to a 501c3 nonprofit or categorizing it as a market expense? So this is a case of an S corp. So the important difference here, when you have a corporation that's giving something to a 501c3 or a charity, is a C corp can only write off up to 5% or 10% now of its net income. So if it makes 100,000, it can donate and deduct 10,000. If it's an individual, you can write off up to 60% of your adjusted gross income. When you're donating products, I think you have a little bit of a different issue. And I'm thinking about donating products. If it's foodstuffs, you can write off the product and write off the charitable gift. If I am donating a product, it gets whatever my basis is.
It has to go towards the feeding of women and children.
That's the food.
Impoverished women and children for food products.
But if you're donating product, so in this particular case, let's just say it's inventory in a business, then it's just going to be, you're just going to not have it there when you do your inventory. Correct. So it's cost of goods sold.
So it won't actually be a charitable deduction. It'll be a write-off of inventory.
Right. It'll be, right. So in that way, you're not actually even, you know, messing around with charitable. The other thing you do, and I think I've talked about this before, is sponsorships out of a C corp or an S corp, you don't have to worry about the charitable amounts. And for those of you guys who are taking the standard deduction, which is $24,400 this year for a married couple, for a single it's $12,200. If you're not necessarily going to exceed that and you're like, oh man, what's another way I can get money to my church or to the organizations I care about, sponsor them through your corporation, and it becomes a business expense to the company. You don't have to worry about a charitable donation. It just comes off the top against the income.
The other one I see occasionally is I donated my cabins to a church group that I usually rent out. What deduction can I get?
You treat it like rent.
You treat it as that was your expense, and that is your write-off.
Yep. With somebody says, with the 50% contingent interest on a flip, are we violating SEC laws? No. It's not the SEC laws. I'm not even certain what laws that would be. Kim, you're going to have to elaborate. There's usury laws, but that's not for commercial. So whenever you're commercial, I can do these contingent. And I could say, hey, pay me 4% interest or 25% of net profit defined as following. And usually what you do is you have your basic note and then you have a contingent interest agreement. It's a second agreement that says, hey, if we make money on it, then here's what I can do. Can a LLC previously established be reconfigured to be taxed as an S corp? Yes, you can. You just have to follow the same rules as making an S election on anything. Can you separate land and property under separate LLCs? Land and property. Property is sitting on the same piece of land. I guess I see what you're saying. In other words, can you take the improvement and toss it in an LLC and have the land on a LLC? I don't see why you would. I imagine you could.
I think it would be very difficult to lease it. You'd have to talk your county into letting you do that.
It would be weird. And I'm not certain the reason you would do it.
Well, for one thing, you'd end up having the parcel amount separately.
Somebody says, do you just let the food deduction wash out the cost of goods? No, actually, John, when you're donating food, I think you actually get to write it off too.
Yeah.
I think you get to do both. And I think that's the big, you get to do
so
both.
So yeah, if you deduct $1,000 worth of food that you donate to a soup kitchen or something, you're going to end up deducting $2,000. So it's your cost of goods sold plus whatever, again, whatever that cost of goods sold as a charitable deduction.
Yeah, and that's why you want to go around. The food banks want to hit up all the bread companies and all these guys that have the day-old bread. You say, give it to me. You can write it off. You know, you're basically writing off the cost, not the retail cost, but whatever it costs you. You're getting to do that twice. Somebody says, do I need to file a 1120 form even if I don't have any taxable income? Yes, you want to grab all your expenses for sure. And even if you didn't have any, you would just say no activity, but you still have to file an expense. Somebody says, what about donating a service? Is there a $10,000? Let's say that you have a design expense of $10,000 and you give the design away. Can you write off the $10,000? The answer is no, because you never recognize the income. So you'd have to, you treat it as though you sold it and had $10,000 and donated $10,000, which is going to be a wash. I have seen people give intellectual property to charities where you get an appraisal on the value of it. You could do that perhaps, where you say, hey, we're giving this and this is what it would be worth. I just don't know whether it's going to be worth it for you to do that, since the appraisal would be probably almost as much as the deduction.
And you're going to have a specialized appraiser to do that valuation.
Mm-hmm. Veronica's asking about wholesaling. Veronica, I have a feeling that the question is going to come up. I see two-member LLC, husband and wife. They did not file a 1065 for 2017. Do they need to amend the 1040 return? The rental activity was reported on Schedule E. So, Patricia, it depends on what state they're in. because in a community property state, they're considered one person. They wouldn't have to do it. Florida, so it's separate property. So technically, they were supposed to file a partnership if they both own it. That's interesting. Here we go. I'm going to deed my rental property into a California LLC. How do I pay the mortgage if it's still in my personal name? So guess what? Mortgage companies will take a payment from anybody.
Was thinking that very thing.
So we'll make it really simple for you. Like I wish it was a little more elaborate. I actually saw a thread on this question, and all these people were throwing in their two cents, and it was like, yeah, we've been doing this for 20-something years. Nobody really cares. Yeah, but you want to make sure that if you have other properties in that LLC, or if it's related to other LLCs, or you're trying to offset other income with it, that it's paying it. Otherwise, the mortgage company is going to be sending it to you. It's going to end up on your Schedule E no matter what. And this is the big thing. A lot of people, when they're doing a mortgage and they start freaking out over the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and the limitations on the mortgage interest deduction on a personal property, that has no effect on your Schedule E. You can still write off the mortgage interest against your rents. But I wouldn't try to move that mortgage into the name of an LLC. I'll just caution you against it. Just go ahead and have that LLC pay the mortgage, or the LLC can receive its rents, distribute it to you, and you could pay that mortgage if it makes you feel better. At the end of the day, it'll have zero impact on your taxes and almost no impact with regards to asset protection. It's highly unlikely that that would ever be a factor, because as long as the California LLC is the one who's actually receiving the monies, and it's receiving it either through a property manager or directly. I am a new real estate investor, and I'm purchasing two properties with cash through my LLC. What kind of financial records should I keep? So I'm going to hit on a couple things. First off, Jeff, I've been Hobarting this whole dang thing, haven't I?
You're doing a great job. You keep everything that has anything to do with those properties. Mm-hmm. You spend a nickel on them, you keep that receipt. If you're able to keep your own records and keep a spreadsheet or something.
Such a CPA. If it's a nickel, you want me to keep a receipt on it.
All right. We'll make it a dime. But still, you need to just dimes add up.
Yeah.
But yeah, anything that has anything to do with a property, you want to keep receipts on. You want to keep your mileage for when you're going to visit these properties and so forth. So it's usually not as much as it sounds like, but you got to be diligent.
Mm-hmm. And realistically, the IRS requires that you keep books and records on all financial activities. So books and records just means a record of your income, a record of your expenses, and a record of your assets. And if you know, when it's real estate, you're allowed to take depreciation. Here's the thing: you're not required to take it, but you are required to recapture it as though you took it. So if you don't take it, you're nuts. So you're going to want to still keep track. What would I keep? I would just keep, like Jeff said, I'd keep a spreadsheet of what comes in and out. And then you could always work with an accountant at the end of the year to fix it. The more concerning thing is you're buying two properties for cash in an LLC, which means something that happens on property one, they're going to take property two and vice versa. So depending on how valuable those properties are, I'd probably recommend that at a minimum, you use land trusts and hold them separately. Since you're buying them for cash, it seems maybe it isn't something that's 100% necessary. I'd probably just use two LLCs. But I don't want to have an activity on one cost me property number two. And it really comes down to, some people would say, well, if they're not very valuable, what if they're $75,000 properties or $100,000 properties? And I'm like, well, I don't really care about that. I care about the rents that are going to come in forever off those properties. And if it's making $1,500 a month and you end up costing yourself it because there's a fire on a property or something happens on one property and they end up taking both, you're going to be kicking yourself saying, shoot, I could have just tossed an LLC around it. So right. if you're doing two properties, I'd caution you. I'd say probably put them in a separate LLC if you can, or use some financing so there's not as much there. Boy, we have a lot of questions that have come in. Let's see. Please elaborate on the wholesaling with a business partner. We have an LLC. We are not renovating and flipping the property. We are truly wholesaling. How can we share the tax burden? That's actually a question that's coming up, and I'll show you how to do that. So I won't answer that just yet. I'll answer it when it comes up. I have an Inc., but how many LLCs can I have under it? I'd like as many as you want. There's no limitation. I'd like to add a foundation along with my two houses and a publishing company that's four LLCs. Is that okay? Yes, you can always do that. Your personal property wouldn't do it, but if you have other rentals, absolutely. And it's just management. And I love to do that. I love to have a management entity that's a family entity that we're running all of our expenses for the, you know, for our active activities. It's just a management company. With 8 vacation rentals and 2 commercial renters and a regular rental, do you recommend 11 LLCs? Yeah, actually, probably. It depends on what they're worth. There's not a one size fits all for anybody. You just have to know what the actual exposure is. And before you go, oh my God, 11 LLCs, some states allow series LLCs, and states quite often 11 LLCs are not nearly as expensive as what you're thinking. In California, it's ungodly expensive, so I wouldn't do that. But if you're in Ohio or Florida or some, where it's not really expensive, it's just really cheap insurance. Yeah, Oregon's not that expensive, like $100 a year. And it can save you considerably. If you ever found yourself on the wrong side of a lawsuit, you'll realize that you're thinking in terms of hundreds of thousands, not even tens of thousands anymore. It's just really, really expensive to defend. And you want to just be able to cut it off and say, here's the total exposure I have. And again, you make sure you have good insurance for each one, and you make sure you have a good umbrella policy so that they're not interested in coming after your other properties. They just put their ears back at the insurance and go, we want some of that. Follow up on the flip queue. Can you deed go 50-50 in 2 separate LLCs owned by the individual partners to avoid partnering with someone in 1 LLC? You can. It's called tenants in common, or you're realistically, I wouldn't do that. I would have an LLC that's a joint venture LLC that's owned by your 2 companies. Or again, try to keep them from being an owner. Somebody says, yep, being sued to the walls right now. Sorry, that just sucks. I hate being on the wrong side of lawsuits. Even on the right side of lawsuits, it still sucks. But it's absolutely, no offense to plaintiff's lawyers, but a lot of them are on contingency and they're partners against you. And they're just using the client to see how much money they can claw into. Just, if it's me, I'm digging my heels in and fighting to the last breath if I can.
And you got to remember that a lawsuit can be expensive even if you win the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we had one of those very recently, and it was $200,000 plus to go win the lawsuit, get a judgment against the tenant that they bankrupted. And the worst part about a lawsuit, guys, isn't the money is annoying. Some of you guys are very well off, and it's waking up at 3 o'clock in the middle of the night and not being able to go back to bed. That's the part that really is, and you're just angry. I've been down that path with so many clients. I had a friend that had died of a heart attack at 52 because part of it's because he was just like always getting into, he had a neighbor that was just suing him every time he turned around. And I said, just move. Get out of there. You just want to be able to wash your hands of it. All right. I just sold a rental property last week and another we sold this week. I think the basis on both may be incorrect. If I find basis on previous bookkeeping records that this is the case, is there a way to correct it? Would it trigger a change in the depreciation? Is there a way to correct the change? So
this you can change without going you've heard us talk about change in accounting method.
Yep.
Because this is a change of estimate, not a change of accounting method. So we just go in and change the numbers and depreciate the new number going forward. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. So what Jeff just said.
Yeah, what I said.
You CPAs. No, Jeff's actually, how many years? 20-something years?
A long time.
Long time he's been the CPA, and I've been a lawyer for not quite as long, a lot younger. All right. Somebody says, would all the LLCs be Wyoming so they're hidden? Not necessarily. So a lot of times what I do is I'll have one LLC in Wyoming that owns the LLCs in the various states. If a lot of you guys know me, we have over 150 rental properties ourselves. And it's like I always say, good luck finding them all. It's never what anybody thinks. And all you're trying to do is make it sure that they're not coming through the back door against you. So they're not trying to take your LLC. So in a lot of states, they're like, oh, well, if I can't get the liability in the property, I'll go after the owner individually and see if I can't take the LLC from them. It's just really frustrating. But then can't a lawyer find them easily? So this is where it gets beautiful. So if I use Wyoming, where you're not disclosed, and set up a bunch of Oregon LLCs, they won't be able to see your name. And so I can keep the Oregon LLCs from having your individual information on them anyway. But again, what we're really worried about is making sure that we don't have them all simply sitting in one big LLC that is very easy to see and they can try to take it all. So there's always a way to do it. We're going to keep moving on. Let's see. This is what you were talking about earlier. I co-wholesaled. So this is wholesale. This isn't flipping. So there is a difference in my own more flippant questions.
Maybe. Let's do this one first.
I have co-wholesaled properties 50-50 with another investor. The deals were made in my company's name. Do I claim disclose the entire amount or only what I received as profit? So the question is, what do you mean by claim and disclose?
Well, you know, I think about they're saying if I wholesale these properties for total of $1 million, whoever's name those sales were on is going to have to report that whole amount.
I'm reporting the million.
And then you're going to deduct from that $1 million.
The amount that I give to my partner.
Exactly.
Right. So what you're doing is you're going to recognize 100% of it. So using Jeff's example of $1 million, and you're going to give them 500,000. That's going to be 1099 MISC, right? It's miscellaneous itemized, not my itemized, miscellaneous income.
Right.
To your the other party, which he's going to kick you in the shins if you give it to him individually. You're going to want to make sure that they're using a company to at least keep the self-employment tax off, depending on how much it is. But yeah, then you would just deduct it. And so all you're showing is your profit. So you would just, you know, so what's the amount that you're actually showing the IRS would be whatever amount you ended up keeping minus your other expenses. And so you could expense. Oh my gosh, here's one I have to answer. I did not claim depreciation on my rental property for the first 15 years. Started taking depreciation 2 years ago. Is there any way to claim 15 years of depreciation I did not take previously?
This goes back to what I was saying about that change of accounting method.
Mm-hmm.
And what the change is you're saying, oh, I originally said I wasn't going to take depreciation. Now I'm changing my method to I'm going to take depreciation. And they're filling out the form 3115 for the change of accounting method.
And then you could take it all?
We can go back and recoup all of those expenses in the current year.
So, Paul, the answer is you should email Tax Tuesday and say, send me to Jeff and let Jeff do take care of you on that. You know what? There's a lot of folks that say, no, that you can't, that if you didn't do it, that you could go back 2 years and you can amend. But what Jeff is saying is arguably correct, which is a chain of accounting method and to go back because you're going to have to recapture it no matter what, which is silly. They'd make you pretend like if you sold that property, you'd have to pay 25% on the amount that you should have depreciated, even though you didn't. That is crazy. Someone says, is there a difference between Nevada and Wyoming LLCs? Yeah, Nevada is more expensive. That's about it. Wyoming doesn't disclose anything. Nevada will disclose officers and directors or the manager of an LLC, but you can use a nominee. So,
but the charging order protection is about the same, isn't it?
They're identical statutes so that people can't take them from you. The good part, so somebody says, hey, I have a whole bunch of LLCs in my home state and it shows my personal name as manager. Is there a way to do something? Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I'm a nominee. I'll just hop on and sign your doc. And now you have a lawyer saying that says nominee. I don't pretend like I'm actually the person. I always put nominee next to my name. And then if there's ever an issue, they like to go after me. And I just say, hey, I'm not going to tell you anything. And it works. 20 something years, never gotten through it. So it works like a charm. Let's see. Somebody says, do you give a 1099 to an individual that helped you find a deal as a referral fee? If you pay somebody, Regina, you're going to want a 1099 on them if it's more than $600.
Right.
So, yeah, we got to keep going through this. Somehow we got it's over an hour. Dang it, Jeff.
Wow. Time flies when you're having fun.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
All right, I have a sales tax judgment, $11,000. I'm on Social Security. I have a traditional IRA with cash. Wife is a realtor, made very little this year, under the $3,000. What is prospected from collection one day would like to do an LLC? So I guess your question really, this is the type of thing that I would prefer that you email in under Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors because I don't want to give you anything that would be perceived as legal advice in front of a whole bunch of people where we're waiving it. But whenever you have tax judgments, depending on whether it's personal or business, they're going to have to renew those every so often. But there's certain assets that are going to be exempt. And so on your particular case, it's going to depend on your state. We'd be able to tell you. We'd also be able to tell you whether or not it's something you could even bankrupt away if you think it's an issue. Somebody says, is it true that if you do a cost segregation, you have to pay everything back if you do a 1031 exchange in the future? No, you're just rolling forward the basis and your basis for
the basis in your property, right?
Yeah. So when you sell the idea in a 1031 exchange, or excuse me, the idea in a cost segregation, is people always say, well, it's ordinary income. Well, no, it's based on the value of the asset that is as it is on the date of sale, and it could actually be long-term capital gains or personal income, depending on the value of it. So Mr. Ron, I want you to email me at TaxTuesday@AndersonAdvisors so we can have somebody help you with that, because it's very specific to your state. Somebody says, I'm licensed with Primerica. Should I create an LLC for my business? It depends on how much you're making, but the answer is almost always going to be yes, because otherwise you're personally responsible for any of the liabilities that are incurred. So you never want to be doing stuff in your personal name. Right. Here we go. We got to jump on. Was the $80,000 saving on the sale of property because of reducing recapture? Yes. So, John, you're hitting it. And without getting into too much detail, it's the idea that if I depreciate my carpet and then sell the house, I shouldn't be paying taxes on recapture on something that has no value.
Right.
That carpet is worthless. It should be gain. And if you don't break that out, you're going to be paying recapture on it. And that seems silly. And so you end up paying a higher tax rate on it. So I hope that makes sense. So it's the fair market value of assets after you've depreciated them, if it's personal property. So, see, John's smart. He's already got it. 1031 exchange, I was not aware of the plan. Is it too late after 60 days? Yeah, but Solfin, what you can do is you can still do qualified opportunity zones if you want to defer the gain. You could still do that. Recapture, it's not going to – oh, yeah, you actually do that qualified opportunity zone on recapture too. Mm-hmm. Now. That's the proposed or the temporary regs address those, right?
Right.
Can I submit – mileage driven from my main work location to a branch office to my employer for reimbursement? The answer is you can submit it, but it doesn't mean they're going to pay it.
My answer exactly. Yes, you can do this if your employer is willing to reimburse you for that.
Now, here's the problem. If they don't reimburse you, you used to be able to do this on a miscellaneous itemized deduction. They're gone now. Tax Cut and Jobs Act got rid of them, so you can't write it off at all.
Here's the other issue. We don't see this very often, but a lot of people don't understand. We talk about the mileage reimbursement being 58 cents a mile.
Mm-hmm.
That's the maximum allowable. That doesn't mean an employer has to give you 58 cents a mile.
They can give you 10 cents a mile, as long as they're, well, we don't want to yell at employers. They usually don't give you anything. Let's just be real.
Yeah.
Or if they do, you got to pull it out of them with the, you know.
But like Toby said, this would really be up to the employer's policy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Somebody else asked, I bought a triplex. I live in one unit, use one as a, must be the residence, and the other as a, oh my goodness, short-term rental, and the other is a long-term. Would it be worth setting up an LLC, let the money roll through? What are the pros and cons? Deshaun, that is an interesting question. That's called, I call it house hacking when you live in one unit and you have the others. That's actually a term, by the way.
House hacking.
It's called house hacking. And so it's when you live in one part of a place. And so what I would end up doing is more likely to stick in the whole thing in an LLC. And then you would depreciate 2/3. You'd cut your expenses. You'd be writing off some of them as personal expense and part of them, 2/3 or whatever the portion is. If you're doing short-term rentals, then the question is whether it's less than 7 days or 7 days or less, not less than 7 days, 7 days or less, because then you'd be considered a hotel and it'd be an active business versus passive. So
how does that affect the 121 exclusion for the sale of principal residence?
There's going to be a period of qualified or non-use. So you'd be able to write off a portion of it, but there'd be a big section of it that would be non-permissible use. So your 121 exclusion would be available to the gain that's attributed to the portion that you used as your personal residence.
Even though it's still in an LLC.
Even though it's still in an LLC, right. So the 121 exclusion is not affected by the disregarded LLC. I guess if you have a partner in it, then that would be another matter. But I don't know a way to break it out. And nor would I want to have somebody who's in a rental being able to follow me around the rest of my life, garnishing me.
Right.
So I tend to always stick things around. And that's what they never tell you. They're always like, oh, you don't need these LLCs. Well, until you've watched, I've had that discussion with somebody that had gray hair and was really ticked off. They will not stop garnishing you. They can renew that judgment about every 10 years in most jurisdictions, and they can just keep garnishing you until you're dead. Let's see. Somebody says, full depreciation or fund depreciation question. I bought a $200 ladder to prepare the hurricane shutters for my rental property. Does this need to be depreciated or just straight expense? If it's a ladder, you just write it off. You got bonus depreciation, 100% this year. So you don't have to give it useful life. And would it be equipment anyway, $179?
Yeah, it's under the $2,500 limit, so.
Yes, you can write it off. And good luck in the hurricane. So anyway, so the mileage reimbursement. Ask your employer and hope that they pay you back. And if not, then just say, hey, I took it on the chin on that one, but I'm going to find other ways to get money out tax-free on some other ways. Here we go. What is the best entity for flipping raw land on an installment sale? What say you, Jeff?
I'm still not sure that I have a real good answer for the entity type, because if it comes under the rules that allows you to do installment sales for parceling land, I would think it would work in almost any entity.
Yeah. So here's the deal. When you have raw land, you just got to be careful that you're not preparing it and developing it. Because if you do, there's no such thing as an installment sale. Now it's dealer property. If you're subdividing it, think six or more, it's dealer property. Even if you don't actually develop it, there's a great case where the individual had it for 11 years, and he was doing the engineering study, but he never pulled the trigger to subdivide it. And they said, your intent when you bought it was to flip it, was to develop it, not even flip it, but it qualifies as dealer activity. And it just ruins you because you have ordinary income and you get no installment sale. So the best entity, if I'm just flipping raw land, and it's just like when you say flipping, I'm doing it through a corporation. It means you bought it to sell it. It's inventory in an installment sale you're not actually supposed to have. So, like, I hate to say this, but the installment sale rules specifically exclude dealer activity and inventory. So it gets kind of stinky. You're supposed to pay the tax now. But if I was doing that, I would probably be running this through a corporation, probably an S-corp, unless I am just buying land as an investment. Here's another one. Someone says, what are the best ways to save on a double close or assignment when wholesaling? Also, is the best tax efficient way in a trust? Because I'm closing on a deal, but signed it under a land trust for anonymity and looking to double close. Yeah, if you can avoid the double close, you just sell the beneficial interest in the land trust. Let's see, when I sell, then he asked another one on personal residence. So Bob, maybe this was a different one. I can't tell if this is two questions. When I sell a personal residence, so first one, let me go back to the double close. So what's the best way to save on a double close and to avoid the double close tax is to use the land trust and sell your beneficial interest. That's all you're doing, is you're literally assigning your beneficial interest to somebody else and they're paying you money so you don't actually have to close. That's going to be your best deal, because when you're closing and you're having to do two closings, there's just going to be costs. Next person says, when I sell my personal residence for $800,000 with a cost basis of $200, profit of $600, how much do I have to reinvest via 1031 to delay payment of taxable gain? Well, you actually have to. So you're doing a 121 plus a 1031 exchange at the same time. The 121 is going to exclude the $500,000, which is going to move your basis in your property from $200,000 to $700,000. When you 1031 exchange, it has to be converted to investment property, which means you have to make it into a rental. And then you're going to 1031 a $800,000 property into at least $800,000 worth of real estate. So I'm not certain whether this is going to get you where you want.
I don't think the 121 reduces his commitment to.
No, no, it's the investment property, the value of it. It's not your gain. It has nothing to do with basis. It has to do with the fair market value. And then you're going to have to buy more. So I would tend to say, hey, I don't know if I would do it under those circumstances. You might be able to save yourself 10 grand. So, maybe if you did it cheap enough and you were going to buy real estate anyway, that would work. Otherwise, I would be looking at adjusting my basis and seeing how much of that $100,000 is actually taxable. Because you're going to have all anything that you put into that property. You may be able to make that gain disappear almost into nothing anyway. Let's see, how could they sell them my interest? You just sell them your interest. We do wholesale trusts all the time. Brandon, this is something you email and text Tuesday. We do these, and we actually have a kit that we could sell you. I think it's like $200, and you could actually use it, and you get you'd save that much in the 10, 20 times that much if you did this thing, if you used it. So we like saving big tranches of money. So everybody thinks this is free. This Tax Tuesday is actually a negative amount because you're saving so much money. Yeah, it's not just free. It's minus thousands of dollars. All right. Can I form an LLC to purchase a vehicle and lease it to myself and then use a capital plan from my C Corp to reimburse me for the lease payments? Don't do that. Stop that.
I was going to say, I'm not a fan of this at all.
Right. You don't need to do the lease and you don't have to do this crazy stuff. Just reimburse yourself. C Corp reimburses you. It's so much cheaper. You guys, I do this stuff day in and day out, and these accountants are always trying to write off stuff in big chunks. Unless it's 50% or more for business, don't even go down that path. And if you do have a car and you have multiple cars, it's so much easier just to do the reimbursement. And then you don't have to worry about the commercial insurance and all this other craziness. Plus, with the lease, you have sales tax, so don't do that. Let's see. Somebody says, how about the best entity for buying and selling raw land by buying tax deeds? Probably doing an S-Corp again, unless you know you're going to keep that property. But if your intent is to sell, you're never going to do that through your individual. See, have an LLC taxed as a C-Corp located in California to manage a property in Florida. Located in California to manage property in Florida. Wow. I don't think I would do that. I would not have a California manager who's going to bring that revenue into California and they're going to tax it. All right, let's keep going on. So they ask these questions sometimes. It makes my brain hurt. How can I rent my home to a corporation in which I am a shareholder?
I kind of feel like this question is similar to the last one. Unless we're talking about that 14 days or less of rental,
yep.
This is just, for me, a bad idea.
So what Jeff is pointing out is that there's a difference between me renting something to somebody, to the corporation, like on a monthly basis. Now, that corporation gets an expense, but I have income.
Right. So let's say I'm renting it out $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
The corporation gets to deduct $12,000, but I'm picking up another $12,000 of income.
But also, now I have a house that's a residence that is also a rental, and I'm going to have to, I have depreciation recapture and all this other stuff. It's much better if I just rent it to my corporation for the meetings that it has once a month. Mm-hmm. Now, that is just tax-free income. It's under 280A-G2. So it's 26 USC 280A, subsection G, subsection 2. And it says that anybody can rent their residence for less than 15 days, which means 14 days. And they don't have to report the income. You don't have to put it on your tax return. So it's great. You don't have to do depreciation. You don't have to do any of that. And the corporation just expenses it. It's probably one of the best tax deductions out there. So, yes, how can I rent my house? You enter into an agreement. I would not do it under a long term. I would not do it on a month to month or a yearly lease. It just doesn't make any sense. So I would not rent your house to a corporation unless you're doing it for like a monthly meeting, and then it has to be 14 days or less.
And going back to what we talked about the depreciation recapture in 121, if you have to start depreciating your home and you have a gain when you sell the house, that depreciation capture is not eligible for that $500,000 exclusion.
Yep.
You have to pay tax on it.
That 121 exclusion is only on capital gains. It's not your cap. Yeah, so you still have the 25%. What is the section for that?
That's 1250.
1250, all right. Too many numbers. Rolling through my head. All right, guys. A lot of really good questions. Feel free to ask more. This is the two for Tuesday. I've thrown this at you guys a few weeks. I'm just going to go over it real briefly. You can do all the TaxWise workshops this year. You get two tickets to a tax and asset protection workshop that we have here in Vegas and other parts of the country. You're going to get two tickets to that. You're going to get a tax and asset protection book for real estate investors, 3-part video series, and a strategy session. Plus, you're going to get all the live stream recordings of all of our TaxWise workshops, including the one coming up in November for $197. Feel free to just email, and I think there might be a link to it somewhere. But you just say, hey, I want the TaxWise and Bulletproof, the two for Tuesday offer. There's some sort of link somewhere. We will shoot it out to you. And of course, Feel free to follow us on social media, AndersonAdvisors.com Facebook, AndersonAdvisors.com YouTube. You can jump on in there and then you ask your questions. Go to just submit it. It's TaxTuesday at AndersonAdvisors.com. All right, a couple more questions. What is the best way to reduce taxes on a large gain after a house flip? So, Cassandra, if you did it in your name, all of that is ordinary income subject to your ordinary tax brackets plus Social Security, which is old age, death, and survivors, and Medicare, that's 15.3%, plus your federal tax, plus your state. So hopefully you did this through a corporation of some sort so we can try to minimize your tax. If you did it through a corporation, then we're going to try to expense the living night out of it. I don't even know how to say it. Living night, that sounds weird.
Daylights?
Daylights, there we go. Daylights. We're going to, the opposite. Somebody says, I listen to your podcast when I'm on the treadmill. See, that's what I like to think about. People out there listening to this stuff while they're sweating, Jeff. They're listening to you while they're sweating.
Well, I'm not sweating, that's for sure.
Sweating out beer. This is our Minnesota Chris. I just know it. Our vodka. They're sweating out the vodka. I had a buddy come over, and he met with a bunch of businesses, and they sell marijuana here. It's all legal. So he's in this room with these guys. He comes back and he goes over to his doctor buddy who yells at him and says, you're sweating out weed. Like he goes, I didn't smoke any. He's like, you're around it. Like these guys. Yeah, I was just laughing at him and go, sure, whatever. You're like Clinton, never inhaled, right? So the best way to reduce tax on, after a house flip is to make sure it's not you. And to there's a lot of deductions, 280A, accountable plan, equipment, all sorts of things, set up your family, medical reimbursement. There's so many different ways to write things off that we will use on your house flip if we can just get it into an entity. Can I do a partial in-kind distribution from an IRA, LLC, Rendlesworth? And I'd like to, oh yeah, so he's doing, yes, you can. So if you have an IRA, LLC, and you're doing, and that's all it is, there's no cash, and you have to do required minimum distributions, or you're just trying to use up some losses, and then you're going to take partial ownership. And it's not illegal to co-own property in an IRA, but you cannot continue, you cannot contribute to it, nor can you use your personal labor to increase the value of it. So no working on that. But you would talk to your IRA custodian. They'll make sure you don't step on any landmines there, Jorge. But yes, you can, because sometimes you don't have cash in it.
Right.
All right, guys, I'll see you on the next Tax Tuesday in 2 weeks. Until next time, this is Toby and
Jeff Webb, and we'll see you next time.
All right, guys, thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.